Okay, we have to jump back to actually chapter 2, because there's some things to put together here. Chapter 2, verse, that's still small, 6. When Joshua dismissed the people of Israel went each to his inheritance to take possession of the land. And the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great work that the Lord had done for Israel. And Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died at the age of 110 years, and they buried him within the boundaries of his inheritance in Timnath-Heres, in the hill country of Ephraim, north of the mountain of Gash. And all that generation also were gathered to their fathers, and there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord or the work that he had done for Israel. And at that point, Delitzsch goes into a very long discussion of exactly what time frame are we talking. And he gives a summary of the back and forth in the total time from the death of Joshua to the rise of the kings. And the total time frame, the total time frame is 480 years from the Exodus from Egypt to Solomon's reign and the building of the temple. Now, if that's the total number of years, and then you take into account how many years of war, how many years of peace in these cycles, and you end up asking, and how many years are left to go from the death of Joshua to the first of the judges? How quickly did the people of Israel become unfaithful? And Yep. About 10 years.
Whoa. That was pretty fast.
Yeah. At which point, some words to explain this. Joshua was, when they got to the Holy Land the first time, he was of legal age. He was in the army. He could have been 20, 30, 40 years old already at that point. He could have been even older than that. You go through the wandering the wilderness, add another 40 years. He's 60, 70, 80 years old. Time to enter Canaan. And then the conquest. And then Joshua, at the end of the conquest, goes home, and he is an old man. God tells him, you're too old to keep this up. You need to turn everything over to the individual tribes and tell them to conquer their territories, and you go home and enjoy your final years. Joshua doesn't live all that long beyond that point. And he dies. He's 110 years old, and we are told that all that generation also were gathered to their fathers. Okay. We have that generation described as, elsewhere, those who saw the mighty acts of God. Now, what are the mighty acts of God? And are we waiting for those who have seen the mighty acts of God in the conquest of Canaan to die? That would be a lot longer than those 10 years. Then what are the mighty acts of God? And you start working backward, and you get to Mount Sinai and what came before that and came after that, the mighty acts of God. Those who were not yet 20 years old, who were not yet of legal age, were not condemned to have their bodies fall in the wilderness and die on the way. So anybody under a certain age would be those who had seen the mighty acts of God and lived through it and came into the Holy Land. And they would be the elders who would lead the people of Israel in the conquest. And when they die, then you say, and there are, that's verse 10, you say, and there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord or the work that he had done for Israel.
I can understand, though, why it wasn't passed down through generation after generation. I mean,
you mean your kids listen to you?
Pardon?
You mean your kids listen to you?
Well, no. But they're aware of my beliefs.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was as much as it could be, huh? Is that what you're saying?
What?
they tried.
Yeah, they tried.
Okay.
But well, you've got all these other influences pulling them away.
But they're saying they didn't know the Lord or what he had done. Like,
including a religion that allows for sex in church. Okay. And the worship of Baal was a fertility worship.
So they're using new as a different connotation than what I am, I guess.
Yeah, the generations exist simultaneously. There are three generations coming along at the same time. And the grandparents died to the parents, hold to what the grandparents believed. Some do, some don't. And those that do, the grandkids, do they hold to what the grandparents believed?
Sometimes more than the parents.
But it very quickly shifts. And well, just go back 20, 30 years in our nation and notice the wide swings. Each generation comes along and we have generation X, generation Y, generation Z, millennial generation, post-millennial generation, and you're talking every 5 to 7 years, saying this is another generation. And it is not necessary for the previous generation to completely die off before the next one starts to assert their own will. And very easily things wander off. So that's the first part. And in that 10 years, you have first, the first story, which is of a Levite who carved out his own gods and went with the tribe of Dan to go up north. And they probably, it was golden calves that they set up there. Why would they do that? And that is Moses's grandson, apparently. And then you've got, and this bears on what we're about to take up, and you've got the failure of morality in the Gibeonites, who made the agreement with Joshua, deceived Israel into saying, okay, you can survive. We won't kill you off. You serve God in the temple. and around the temple, the Gibeonites were involved in rape and murder. And when the Israelites come together, form this congregation, this voters' assembly, to decide what to do about it, and they demand of the Benjaminites, turn over everyone who is involved in this. And the Benjaminites say, no, they may be rapists and murderers, but they're our rapists and murderers. You can't have them. And then there's this war in Israel, and one tribe's almost wiped out. And then, oh, what will we do? What will we do? Well, we'll tell the Benjaminites that have survived that they can go and kidnap young ladies from this one festival. This is a runaway voters assembly. And this is all within these 10 years, because as Delitzsch labels it, it's from the division of the land to the invasion of Cushan Rishathaim, 10 years. And it propels us right into this whole business. Got one more thing to dig out here. Verse 16 of chapter 2. Mishpatim. Okay. Okay. God raised up judges. Who are the judges? What are they? There is another word for the judges that's going to sneak in here right away when we get to the first of the judges. But the first of the judges will be Othniel, Caleb's nephew. And there's an alternate translation that would make Othniel Caleb's younger brother, but I don't see a reason to follow that. So we get to chapter 3. Oh. So we're in chapter 3, verse 1. Now these are the nations that the Lord left to test Israel by them, that is, all in Israel who had not experienced all the wars in Canaan. Verse 2.
It was only in order that the generations of the people of Israel might know war, to teach war to those who had not known it before.
Mm-hmm. These are the nations of the five lords of the Philistines and all the Canaanites and the Sidonians and the Hivites who lived on Mount Lebanon from Mount Bel Hermon as far as Lebo Hamath. Okay, verse 4.
They were left to test the Israelites to see whether they would obey the Lord's commands, which he had given their forefathers through Moses.
So the people of Israel lived among the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And verse 6.
And their daughters they took to themselves for wives, and their own daughters they gave to their sons, and they served their gods.
And they served their gods. So they took the perspective that God was one God among many gods, and on and on and on. And so they adopted some of the pattern of worship of from the worship of Baal. They, at one point there was a worship of Baal Jehovah, combining the names, and saw God as just a force of nature God among other force of nature gods. And so it made perfect sense to them when that one Levite, Jonathan, by name, had carved out his own gods, and the people of Dan went off with him, some of the people of Dan. And once you have done that, you disconnect from the eternal right and wrong, and stuff happens. Among the stuff that happened was that one of the tribes was almost destroyed. The people of Israel in general, they were somewhat devastated by that war. A lot of people died. And when your army is nearly wiped out, what then happens? Somebody from outside sees it as an opportunity, such as a guy named Cushan-Rishathaim. And we dig into this. Verse 7, and the people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. They forgot the Lord their God and served the Baals and the Asheroth. That would be plural, Asheroth. So the male fertility god figures and the female fertility god figures. Verse 8.
The anger of the Lord burned against Israel so that he sold them into the hands of the Cushan-Rishathaim, king of Aram-Naharaim, to whom the Israelites were subject for 8 years.
Okay. It has a rhythm to it. Cushan-Rishathaim. Cushan-Rishathaim. Yeah. So there is... Cushan-Rishathaim is king of, in this translation, Mesopotamia.
Yeah, the original is this is not
just a local king. This is an interloper from outside the Holy Land area saying, there's been war there, they're all weak, I'm going in. And the people of Israel served Cushan-Rishathaim 8 years. And you were saying?
Oh, the Hebrew is Naharaim.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Verse 9. But when the people of Israel cried out to the Lord raised up a deliverer for the people of Israel who saved them, Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother. The Lord raised up a deliverer for them. What's the word for deliverer?
Moshiach.
What verse are we at?
Messiah.
What verse are we at?
Nine.
Verse 9. Okay.
Moshiach.
And the Lord raised up a
Messiah.
Moshiach for them. Which you probably have noticed that Moshiach is similar to Mashiach. And Mashiach is Messiah. Mm-hmm. Which would mean an anointed one, technically, but a Messiah, Moshiach, has the sense that can carry the prophetic office, and somewhat of the intercessor priestly function, and somewhat of the ruler. The three aspects that then separate into prophet, priest, and king, and then get reunited when you come to Christ in the New Testament. So these are foreshadowings all the way through. And each one of these is then a deliverer in that sense. A deliverer and a judge. We will go into a little bit more detail when we get to Deborah, who takes on very specific roles. But so Cushan-Rishathaim has Othniel rise up against him. Verse 10.
The Spirit of the Lord came upon him so that he became Israel's judge and went to war. The Lord gave Cushan, king of Aram, into the hands of Othniel, who overpowered him.
Okay. So the land had rest 40 years. Then Othniel, the son of Kenaz, died. So 8 years of trouble, and that followed by 40 years where there was a judge in place. And the function of the judge was to judge right and wrong. And he would judge right and wrong in two aspects. Right and wrong between the people of Israel, deciding cases that lower courts couldn't, he would decide. And secondly, he would judge right and wrong in the relationship of Israel to foreign nations. And if Israel was being oppressed, then there was time to judge the right and the wrongness of that, and God to give him the spirit and the impetus to go and correct the wrong. Okay, that's the first one. Verse 12.
And the people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord strengthened Eglon, the king of Moab, against Israel, because they had done what was evil in the sight of the Lord.
Okay. So again, they wander off. Once there is gone the person speaking right and wrong, then everything breaks loose again. Why is that? Why is that a part of our nature? Sin. And so God strengthened Eglon, king of Moab. Verse 13, he gathered to himself the Ammonites and the Amalekites, historic enemies of Israel, and went and defeated Israel, and they took possession of the city of Palms. Anybody know what the city of Palms actually is?
Jericho.
Yes, Jericho. Okay, which at that point the city is rebuilt, but not the surrounding wall and fortifications. That would be built later, and the curse attached to it, laying the foundations at the death of his firstborn and completing them at the death of his lastborn. But verse 14.
The Israelites were subject to Eglon, king of Moab, for 18 years.
Mm-hmm. Then the people of Israel cried out to the Lord, and the Lord raised up for them a deliverer. That there is that name again, Moshiach. Ehud, the son of Gera, the Benjaminite, a left-handed man.
The Hebrew Why is idiom, that significant?
The Hebrew idiom for this is not skilled with his right hand. Because everybody saw the right hand as the normal. So if you were left-handed, there was a defect in your right hand. Yeah. That didn't disappear until the last century.
Yeah.
Okay. But it's significant. Verse 16.
Now Ehud had made a double-edged sword about a foot and a half long, which he strapped to his right thigh under his clothing.
Okay. And when they patted him down, they didn't check there. And he presented the tribute to Eglon, king of Moab. Now, Eglon was a very fat man. You know, laying the groundwork for events in the story from later. Verse 18.
And when Ehud had finished presenting the tribute, he sent away the people who carried the tribute.
Okay. But verse 19 says, but he himself turned back at the idols near Gilgal. So he went away with those who were carrying the tribute. Those carrying and an armed guard, and he is supervising this, and they get to the idols at Gilgal, and he sends them back home, and he himself turns back. Verse 19, but he himself turned back at the idols near Gilgal and said, I have a secret message for you, O king. And actually, that's a very loose translation because he would not have had access to go right up to the king and say this. He would have sent a message through the servants at the door. I have a secret message for you, O king. And he commanded silence. And all his attendants went out from his presence. Verse 20.
And Ehud came to him as he was sitting alone in his cool roof chamber. And Ehud said, I have a message from God for you. And he arose from his seat.
Okay. And it is still the way of it that up on the roofs of the houses, there is a covered area where you can sit up there and enjoy the breeze. So that's where he would have been. It could be curtained in and the breeze allowed to blow through, or in cooler days, the curtains closed and such and such. Sort of a curtained three-season room, if you will. And it could be a pleasant place to be in the heat of the year. And then Eglon gets up from his seat, stands up to hear this message because he thinks it's very, very important. Verse 21, and Ehud reached with his left hand, took the sword from his right thigh and thrust it into his belly. Okay. Someone gets to read verse 22.
Even the handle sank in after the blade, which came out his back. Ehud did not pull the sword out, and the fat closed in over it.
Okay, and I have, and the dung came out.
Oh, I don't have that. My version.
When you're teaching a young boy's Old Testament class, you pause here.
Yeah, I bet.
Give them a few moments to just enjoy it among themselves.
Yuck.
Then Ehud went out into the porch and closed the doors of the roof chamber behind him and locked them. So I'm not entirely clear exactly what the sequence is, but he manages to leave and lock the doors behind him. And it sounds like they're locked from the inside. And consequently, the events that follow. Verse 24.
When he had gone, the servants came, and when they saw that the doors of the roof chamber were locked, they thought, surely he is relieving himself in the closet of the cool chamber.
Okay. We got an idiom here. Idiom.
Surely he covers his feet.
Surely he covers his feet. That's their euphemism. What do you mean, surely he covers his feet? Well, he's got his pants down around his feet. Okay. It's the idiom. It's the euphemism. Surely he covers his feet in the closet of the cool chamber. And they waited till they were embarrassed to the point of embarrassment. But when he still did not open the doors of the roof chamber, they took the key and opened them. And there lay their Lord dead on the floor. How long did they wait? 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, half an hour? You know, it depends on his bathroom habits previously. And when you've allotted that much time and probably another half that much, then you begin to get uneasy. A fat man like Eglon will probably also be somewhat constipated, just as routine. So I'm going to give Ehud 45 minutes or more head start. Does that sound reasonable?
I'm surprised they go in such detail, tell such detail.
Yeah.
It's probably male writers.
That's so they can get the teenage boys to read it. yeah.
Something they would leave out.
Well, then the teenage boys wouldn't be as interested. There's a plan and a scheme in all of this. But it also involves mockery of the enemy.
And it could be, too, to give his attendants an excuse of why they waited so long. Mm-hmm. You know, they're...
Okay, let's go on. Verse 26.
While they waited, Ehud got away. He passed by the idols and escaped to Syria.
Mm-hmm. When he arrived, he sounded the trumpet in the hill country of Ephraim. Now, this is Ehud, Benjaminite, who lives in the hill country of Ephraim. That's the mountains north of Jerusalem. We've heard about the hill country of Ephraim regularly through this whole reading of the book of Judges. But then the people of Israel went down with him from the hill country, and he was their leader. Verse 28.
Follow me, he ordered, for the Lord has given Moab, your enemy, into your hands. So they followed him down, and taking possession of the fords of the Jordan that led to Moab, they allowed no one to cross over.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So suddenly, it's not safe for the Moabites to be in Israel. The situation has changed completely, and they need to get out of the country. But Ehud and his crew have seized the fords of the Jordan and not letting anybody cross over. And they killed at that time about 10,000 of the Moabites, all strong, able-bodied men, not a man escaped. 30.
Moab was subdued that day under the hand of Israel, and the hand had rest.
And the
land had rest for 80 years.
80 years. So we've had invaders from the northeast, from Mesopotamia, and from the south and east, Moab, bringing in also the Ammonites and the Amalekites. And the third of the judges is Shamgar, that we are not told anything about, except after him was Shamgar, the son of Anath, who killed 600 of the Philistines with an ox goad. And he also saved Israel. The nearest implement at hand, when suddenly the time comes and he turns against the Philistines. Oh, the Philistines, those are from the west, from along the coast, and they're making incursions as well. So from three directions. It's a busy time. Any questions on chapter 3? I say with some trepidation here. There are things we don't know. Chapter 4. And the people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord after Ehud died. Okay, and we're not told how long after Ehud died that they did evil. Did he live a full 80 years after driving out the Moabites?
Or was it Ehud and then Shamgar?
No, it says
the 80 years
after Ehud died.
Yeah.
So it may have taken a while for them to wander back into doing evil.
Mm-hmm.
verse 2.
And the Lord sold them into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. The commander of his army was Sisera, who lived in Harosheth Hagoyim. Mm-hmm.
Okay, Hagoyim, Goyim would be nations. Harosheth of the nations would be the meaning of it. It is north of the north of a certain lake. Lake Hula. North of Lake Hula in the tribe of Naphtali is where Hazor is. Harosheth of the Goyim. And Sisera has 900 chariots of iron. We don't know where Harosheth was. We just don't know. It hasn't been found. Verse 3, then the people of Israel cried out to the Lord for help, for he, that is Sisera, had 900 chariots of iron, and he oppressed the people of Israel cruelly for 20 years. Okay. Verse 4 is interesting. Somebody read verse 4.
Now Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth, was judging Israel at that time.
Okay. Deborah is called a prophetess, and Isha Naviah. Navi is prophet. You put the ah, which is the feminine ending on it. Adam was Ish, male. Isha,
female,
a woman. Isha Naviah.
A prophetess.
Yeah. And she is called that very straightforwardly. Also, it does not say that God raised up Deborah the prophetess after Israel became subject to Jabin and Sisera. Does not say that. It says that she was judging Israel at that time, which gives us a clue into something else. Namely that the whole idea of the judge might not have been vacated when the one died, but another one could be raised up. And regardless of whether Israel was free or being occupied, there would still be a judge in place, which actually that's kind of interesting. So she was there doing the work of a judge, regardless that there's an invading army. She's still the judge. Hmm. Verse 5, she used to sit under the palm of Deborah. Oh, so she found a palm of Deborah? No, she sat under a palm, and it got the name the Palm of Deborah, because that's where she held court. She used to sit under the palm of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim. There is the hill country again. And the people of Israel came up to her for judgment. Okay. Now, inspired by the Holy Spirit, here comes verse 6.
She sent and summoned Barak, the son of Abinoam from Kadesh Naphtali, and said to him, "Has not the Lord, the God of Israel, commanded you, go gather your men at Mount Tabor, taking 10,000 from the people of Naphtali and the people of Zebulun?"
Okay. So, inspired by God, she summons Barak, and he's from Kadesh Naphtali. There's also a Kadesh Barnea, Kadesh this, Kadesh that. This is the Kadesh, city of Kadesh, that is in the territory of Naphtali. Like Springfield-Illinois, Springfield-Missouri, okay?
Springfield, Oregon.
Has not the Lord, the God of Israel, commanded you? He's being summoned. Go gather your men at Mount Tabor, taking 10,000 from the people of Naphtali and the people of Zebulun. And Zebulun and Naphtali are both northern territories. Think Vermont and New Hampshire, if you want to think certain kind of an area.
I didn't think you'd mind, but I just wanted to.
And gather your men, head to Mount Tabor. Mount Tabor becomes very important because Mount Tabor is north of the plain of Jezreel, sloping up to a mountain and then flat on top. And there are some structures up at the flat top of it. Okay, so go there. Verse 7, "And I will draw out Sisera, the general of Jabin's army, to meet you by the river Kishon with his chariots and his troops, and I will give him into your hand." So, very simply, those are the directions. Go there, engage in battle, God will deliver him. Verse 8.
Pastor, God talked directly to the judges then?
At times. At times directly, at times just the inspiration of the Spirit.
Okay.
Dalich does question whether Ehud was correct in lying to Eglon, or was the message from the Lord, well, the message from God was the sword. But
okay,
there is some deception, there is assassination, there is murder. Was that inspired? That would be a generations long discussion. But Deborah has a word from God and speaks that word to Barak. And Barak says, verse 8,
"Barak said to her, 'If you go with me, I will go, but if you don't go with me, I won't go.'"
Dalich gives a better reason for that than simple unsureness of his own ability. Deborah is seen as the prophetess and judge, and Barak wants to have that inspiration there available to his army, because an army that is inspired can be a very deadly army. And so it can lead the men of the army to great deeds. And he also is a bit unsure of himself. Verse 9, "And she said, 'I will surely go with you, Nevertheless, the road on which you are going will not lead to your glory, for the Lord will sell Sisera into the hand of a woman. Then Deborah arose and went with Barak to Kadesh.
Okay. And it wasn't Deborah the woman. And no. It wasn't Deborah.
No. Verse 10.
And Barak called out Zebulun and Naphtali to Kadesh. And 10,000 men went up at his heels, and Deborah went up with him.
Okay. Meanwhile, off in a tent elsewhere, now Heber the Kenite had separated from the Kenites, the descendants of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses, and had pitched his tent as far away as the oak in Zananim, which is near Kadesh. Okay, we'll just leave that note to the side until later. Verse 12.
When they told Sisera that Barak, son of Abinoam, had gone up to Mount Tabor.
Okay. Sisera called out all his chariots, 900 chariots of iron, and all the men who were with him from Harosheth Hagoyim to the river Kishon. And the battlefield is the plains around the river Kishon. Verse 14.
And Deborah said to Barak, "Up, for this is the day which the Lord has given Sisera into your hand. Does not the Lord go out before you?" So Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him.
Now, there's an interesting thing. If the battle takes place here, it ends up with one result. If it takes place there, it ends up with another result. Verse 15, and the Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots and all his army before Barak by the edge of the sword, and Sisera got down from his chariot and fled away on foot. Why would he get down from his chariot and flee on foot?
Probably if they're in the river bottom land, it's muddy and hard to maybe drive the chariot through.
And if Barak doesn't go down to there and Sisera and his chariots get part way up, what will be the condition of the ground there?
Right.
A lot easier to drive the chariots. But at the bottom land, strangely enough, the advantage is to those on foot.
Well, the other possibility too, it says, the next verse says, and Barak pursued the chariots and the army of Harosheth. So it's possible it was misdirection.
Some of them got away in chariots and Sisera
snuck off the other direction.
Sisera's chariot got stuck. Hmm. Now, if you have your chariot, you can flee pretty fast. Now you got horses pulling it. Do you want to try and chase down a horse? Mm. No, no. But without Sisera, the rest of them are lacking in direction. Okay. So verse 16.
And Barak pursued the chariots and the army to Harosheth Hagoyim, and all the army of Sisera fell by the edge of the sword. Not a man was left.
Okay. Wiped out the whole army. Except for Sisera. Sisera got away. Verse 17, but Sisera fled away on foot to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. For there was peace between Jabin, the king of Hazor, and the house of Heber, the Kenite. Heber had moved away from. Verse 18.
And Jael came out to meet Sisera and said to him, "Turn aside, my lord, turn aside to me. Do not be afraid." So he turned aside to her into the tent, and she covered him with a rug. Wow.
And he said to her, "Please give me a little water to drink, for I am thirsty." So she opened a skin of milk and gave him a drink and covered him. What's milk do?
Put you to sleep.
Yep. Verse 20.
Stand in the doorway of the tent, he told her. If someone comes by and asks you, "Is anyone here?" say no.
Mm-hmm. Does one of the women want to read verse 21?
But Jael, Heber's wife, picked up a tent peg and a hammer and went quietly to him while he lay fast asleep, exhausted. She drove the peg through his temple into the ground, and he died.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Cue the Monty Python line.
Yeah.
Nailed him to the... She nailed me under the floor. Okay. And behold, as Barak was pursuing Sisera, Jael went out to meet him and said to him, "Come and I will show you the man whom you are seeking." So he went into her tent, and there lay Sisera dead with the tent peg in his temple. 23.
So on that day, God subdued Jabin, the king of Canaan, before the people of Israel.
And the hand of the people of Israel pressed harder and harder against Jabin, the king of Canaan, until they destroyed Jabin, king of Canaan. Okay.
It doesn't explain why Jael killed him, because it said that they had friendly relations.
Yeah. She apparently saw her loyalty to the people of God, to Israel, and to the God of Israel.
Yeah.
We'll say that as the most positive way we can say it, right?
Sure.
And Rahab let the spies down through the window. And so God calls people to know him and walk with him. And they've got some rough edges when they begin to walk with God. That's one of the interesting parts of being a church, is you get to see people come in with rough edges, and then you get to watch God work on them. It's just, when somebody comes in with rough edges, don't go and point out all their rough edges. Let God do that work.